You are listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind, the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. Hi, I'm Lyle Troxell. And now, some corrections. Last week in the episode, Big Solar Sends Kids to the AI Mine, we talked about a North Carolina town, a citizenry that defeated a Big Solar plan to suck up the sun. Now, that's the story we ran with. It was a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, and basically we were poking fun at this town on deciding not to have a big solar farm installed. The truth of the story, of course, is much more nuanced. David Porter wrote in and linked to a wonderful article at Snopes talking about the North Carolina town and why they did what they did. A really wonderful read up there. And Jim from Central Jersey wrote in, and let me just get the tenor of his letter. I was a bit perturbed at the easy dismissal of the citizens of Woodland, North Carolina, when they didn't want another solar farm in their town. Granted, the woman who blames solar for the increase in cancer is an easy target, but I think the real problem has to do with these small rural towns. A few points. Woodland is one of those towns that has little going on for it. They've already got solar farm on three sides, evidently. The most recent dispute is about closing the fourth side of their town. Now, solar farms, once built, don't generate a lot of jobs, and the only thing this town has going for it is the land, which, if it's covered by solar panels, can't be used for farming or anything else. So, the teacher's argument that nothing grows beneath panels is cogent only for a largely farming community, especially if there's no other visible source of growth in the town. And this is probably my favorite part of Jim's letter. Younger folks generally move away as soon as they can. There's nothing to keep them there. Leaving behind older residents. Older people are often sicker, so there might, in fact, be a larger proportion of cancer sufferers in the town. And back to me. Thank you, Jim, for that. Especially, of course, if the industry is only solar farms, which do not have a lot of job potential for younger employees. The episode is Big Solar Sends Kids to the AI Mine at geekspeak.org, and Dave and Jim's letters are up there, along with a whole write-up and pictures from last week's show. And of course, if you didn't listen to last week's show, you're welcome to subscribe to the podcast from geekspeak.org and listen to every episode back to 2006 and maybe a few even before that. Hey, this week I got really interested in the senses. You know, the five senses: touch, sight, smell, taste, and of course, hearing, which is important for radio. And in looking into the senses, I got intrigued by this book. We Have the Technology: How Biohackers, Foodies, Physicians, and Scientists Are Transforming Human Perception One Sense at a Time. It's a deep dive into how technology boundaries are shaped around the senses. It's written by Kara Platani, a independent science journalist up in San Francisco. In fact, she's a lecturer of journalism at the graduate school at UC Berkeley. So I gave her a ring to talk about her book. Kara, how long have you been working on We Have the Technology, your book?
So I started, the idea came to me almost exactly 3 years ago, but the actual running time for how long this book took to produce is really only 15 months, and that's because I teach. So I took 1 year off of school, and then I had a summer. And in that time, I basically sofa surfed my way through 8 U.S. states and 4 countries, if you count the U.S. as one of the countries. And I interviewed more than 100 people, and I tried to get a really wide variety of people. So not just lab scientists and academics, but military researchers, biohackers, people at private companies, entrepreneurs, everyone I could find.
I figured we'd start by just tackling one of the basic senses, and taste felt like a great thing for radio. So let's talk a little bit about taste. Specifically, tell me what happened when you went to Denver, to the Denver Museum of Natural Sciences, in your little lab experiment.
Okay, so if you happen to be going to Denver, you can probably still get in on this. The Denver Museum of Nature and Science is running a crowdsourced experiment. They're searching for the sixth basic taste. And what that means is, well, if you, like me, went to elementary school in the 20th century, you probably remember your science teacher telling you there are only four basic tastes. There's salty, sweet, sour, and bitter. And then all of a sudden, in your 2000, along came this new idea, this basic taste called umami. It's a Japanese concept, and it means savoriness. And the thing that made it accepted in the United States, after a century of it having been accepted in Japan, was that scientists found a receptor on the tongue that locks with the amino acid glutamate. So they said, okay, there is a receptor on the tongue that locks with this molecule the same way that your sweet receptor locks with sugar. This is a new basic taste. Right. And the rest of us learn to perceive this new concept. We learn to pick it out in food. We have an idea of what savory means, what foods to associate with it, like the taste of grilled meat, caramelized onions, Parmesan cheese is very common, commonly listed as a umami-rich food.
And to be clear, in Japan, umami had been well accepted since the turn of the previous century.
Yes, it was discovered in Japan in 1908, and it had been well known. In fact, the Japanese food company Ajinomoto had been manufacturing MSG, monosodium glutamate, which is kind of an umami enhancer, as a food additive since 1909. So it was really well known.
When you say umami enhancer, is it the umami flavor, like salt? Table salt is the salt flavor, or is it something that accentuates umami?
It actually has glutamate in it. It has that amino acid that clicks into that receptor on your tongue. So it helps you taste umami.
Now, one of the things that happens when we start talking about taste, and we mentioned that there's only five and you're looking for the sixth, is that to me, it feels like there's so much more taste. But of course, I understand that most of what I think of as taste is actually smell. And that's pretty clear if you fill up your nose with something and then try to taste things.
Yes. So you're absolutely right. This is why you can't taste much of anything when you have a really bad cold. It's because your sense of smell isn't working, not because your tongue stopped working. So what people tend to think of as taste is really flavor. And flavor means the mouth and the nose working together. So when you eat all of these molecules of food scent rise up into your nasal passages. It's called retronasal olfaction, which is not delicious sounding, but it makes things delicious. And so it's basically your nose and your tongue working together to process this sensation and combination.
Okay, so you go to the Denver Museum. They're doing a crowdsourced experiment on people to see if there is a possibility to talk about the sixth taste. What are they doing in Denver? What are they looking at as the possible sixth taste?
Okay, so the contender that they're testing in Denver is fat. And the argument for why we should be able to taste fat is that your body needs it. It's something we have to eat. So it should be something that we can sense in the food supply. And when I say fat, I don't mean the taste of ice cream or the taste of gravy or the taste of bacon. I mean the actual taste of the fat molecule itself. So in Denver, what they do is they give you these little tiny wafers about the size of a postage stamp. They're kind of like those melt-away breath strips, if you've ever used those before.
I like that gel, like a gel that melts away in your tongue.
Yeah, exactly. It's a wafer gel. And instead of having a mint flavor in it, it has linoleic acid, which is a basic fatty acid. Okay. And then they give it to you and they see if you can differentiate between different wafers that have different amounts of the linoleic acid in it. It's called a scaling test.
And you did this, right?
Yeah, I did this. And I will tell you right now, I don't want to predispose too much anybody who wants to go to Denver to participate, but I will tell you, it does not taste like bacon. To me, it tasted awful. But I could absolutely taste it. There was definitely something there.
If it tastes awful, doesn't that go against the idea of it? I mean, I guess bitter tastes bad too, but we have a taste for that. So is it a protection mechanism? I mean, if the theory was that we need fat and therefore we should have a taste ability of tasting fat, then it tasting awful seems to be reverse of what the desired effect.
Right. Okay, so this is really important. So scientists who study food say the basic tastes have to serve a useful purpose. They're either attractive or aversive. So either they're leading you to sweet things, which signals where calories are, or to savory things, which signals where protein is, or it's warning you away from toxins, which tend to be bitter, right? So the idea about fat is it's very hard to tell. This is one of the big areas of debate, is whether fat is a taste or whether it's a mouthfeel. If it's actually a texture and it's something that is conveyed to the brain through your nerves that convey touch rather than your nerves that convey taste.
And this means, I mean, it's very hard to distinguish this, of course, because if your tongue is both the taste and the touch at the same time, how would you possibly know which one your brain is actually paying attention to? And I'm assuming that it's almost always a combination.
Right. So when it's actually in your mouth, you're doing both things at once. So in animal studies, they can do things that they don't do to people. Like they will actually sever the trigeminal nerve, the nerve that carries sense of touch, and they'll see if the animal can still react. And that would show that it is a taste sensation as well. So the researcher who's kind of championing fat as a sixth taste is Dr. Richard Mattis at Purdue University. And he says, here's the deal for why it should be kind of good and kind of bad. He thinks the mouthfeel of fat is attractive because it is something that we do need to eat. So it should feel good. We should like to eat it. But free fatty acids are generated when food spoils. And so he thinks actually we should find it aversive in large quantities. We should know if we're eating it, okay, this is spoiled food. We should stay away from it.
With the idea that in nature, if you're eating something good, like an animal you've just killed to eat that, the level concentrate of fat is going to be at a normal level. But as it starts to spoil, everything starts to turn into the same type of protein. Then your body will be like, oh, that's not good. So there's kind of a boundary level there.
Right. Don't eat the decayed stuff.
Okay. So you tasted this stuff, put it on your tongue. You didn't find that it was tasty. You didn't like it. But how'd you describe it?
Okay, so this is the really hard part, right? So it turns out that what's going on in the search for a basic taste, they actually have a word problem. And it all hinges on this idea, do you need a word before you can perceive something? Or do you have to perceive it before your culture built a word for it? In other words, can you taste something if you don't know what you expect to taste, if you don't have a word to describe that thing? So part of the challenge at the Denver Museum was to figure out how to describe this thing. So when I put it in my mouth, the first thing I thought of was bitter.
Right.
But that's already one of the five, right? And then so I thought, okay, well, it's kind of sour. And that's another one of the five, right? So I had to kind of spitball to come up with words that were unique to the sensation that I was tasting. And the words that I came up with were like plastic and solvent and PVC piping and shoe leather
metaphor,
and old luggage.
Yeah.
Metaphors, right?
Yeah. Which is what
because
we use
I
when
don't
we
have a word for it.
Right. And we'd like to use metaphor when language, when our vocabulary doesn't reach far enough. But this, what you're talking about is not whether you could taste it or not, because clearly you could taste it, but you could not actually talk about it directly. And therefore a shared experience couldn't be created. Therefore, a shared cultural experience couldn't exist, and therefore it's a question of whether it's just in you or if it's really in the world. So this comes down to this idea of whether vocabulary. So you quote Mike Tardoff and Gary Bouchamp, who both argue two different sides of this. Will you go ahead and argue Gary Bouchamp's idea?
Okay, yeah. So Gary, his name is Gary Beauchamp, and he is, he is the president of the Monell Chemical Senses Center, which is this giant food research center in Philadelphia. And he says, look, if people can't universally perceive it, then no culture has built a word for it. And the reason that we know that saltiness and sweetness and bitterness are basic tastes perceived by everybody is because those words are universal through languages. Mm-hmm. Everybody has them because everybody can understand them. And he says it is possible that the body needs fat and it needs some of these other chemicals that are contenders for other six tastes. But he thinks that our detection of those happens subconsciously at a level below detection, that we don't have a percept in our mind for those individual things. So yes, maybe we eat them. Yes, maybe the body has a way of sensing that they're there, but it doesn't rise to the level of consciousness. There is kind of a precedent for this in the world of sensory science, and the precedent is in the field of vision. And the idea is some cultures don't have separate words, for example, for blue and for green. It's one word and they're perceived as one singular visual experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that people in those cultures, if you show them the UV light spectrum, that their eye works any differently than anybody else's does, or that they literally can't see those colors, the shades of blue and green.
It's not a colorblind thing. You can take a shade of blue and a shade of green and put them on top of each other and still read text and all that. You see them as different things. There's just no word to separate them.
Right. And what's happening in your mind is that you perceive them as one thing, one unit, rather than as two separate things. And I've actually spent a lot of time staring at, you know, rainbows, not actual rainbows, photographs of rainbows, saying, yeah, that's true. It is very hard to tell where one color ends and where another begins. What if we invented a new color called super orange that was one specific band of orange, and we all became sensitive to that and had a unique word for it and could pick it out of the spectrum as its own thing? One of my sources was telling me, yeah, actually, in Russia, we have two different words for blue. There's kind of a dark royal blue, and then there's kind of what we might call an English cyan. And people distinguish between those as separate colors, whereas in English, we would say they're all blue, right? So it's a matter of category sorting in the mind. And that might be what's happening with taste, is that we're all tasting the same thing. Tongue functions the same way. Messages go to the brain the same way. But we don't have a way to pick out these experiences as singular, as individual, as discrete. And maybe that's why I was struggling so much with this taste of fat, wanting to call it bitter or sour, because those were kind of like the closest bands in the taste rainbow, the things I already had a word for.
But with light, we're talking about mixes. We know that there's only there's only three color perceptors or light perceptors in the brain, and they're mixed in. I mean, or maybe is it four? I can't recall. But with taste, we also have the perception, the cell perception capability, right? The taste receptors, the thing that actually bind with the chemical that actually allow you to detect something. We know there's a salt one. We know there's sugar. There's something like 15 or 20 bitters, ones that detect bitter. So in some sense, we know some basic building blocks of the sensation that we call bitter. Where is it taste and where is it chemical reaction? Where does our mind decide what it is? Those are all different layers, right?
Yeah, this is kind of the magic of what's going on with sensory science right now. When I was talking with Michael Tordoff at Monell Chemical Sensor Center, he said, look, we understand the outside of the body really well. We understand the tongue really well because we can get to it. But what's happening in the brain, that is much, much harder to get to. So this whole translation between what happens when chemical locks onto tongue and then the image, the sensation that you have in your mind, this is much, much newer and much harder to unravel, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is why scientists are debating, okay, what do we really care about? Do we really care about the biochemical action on the tongue? Or do we really care about what happens in the mind, the percept? Do we care about the psychology, the cognitive science side of this? And up until the turn of the century, people were really on the psychology side. And now, since the cracking of the human genome, since the popularization of the use of fMRI scanners, which gave us a lot of insight into brain activity, neuron activity, since the development of transgenic lab animals that made it much more easier to figure out, you know, the link between gene and receptor and animal behavior, the focus has really shifted over to biochemistry. Mm. That said, there are people in my book who say, who cares? Who cares how many there are? Who cares what names we give them? The important thing is the experience that you have when you're eating. Ultimately, that is the only thing that matters.
Cara Platone is a freelance science writer. I'm speaking with her about her book, We Have the Technology, How Biohackers, Foodies, Physicians, and Scientists Are Transforming Human Perception, One Sense at a Time. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. We'll be right back. Cara Platone is a freelance science writer. I'm speaking with her about her book, We Have the Technology. Cara, let's go on from taste. Let's move on to biohackers, people that are actually modifying their bodies. Can you talk a little bit about this experience? I mean, I heard years ago about inserting a small silicon bead with a magnet inside it in your hand, and that over time, because the bead would move when electricity fields interacted with it, over time you'd actually gain a sense of being able to detect electricity. Is that real?
So it's real in that people are doing it. Absolutely. There are tons of people who have magnetic implants right now. The bigger question is what exactly is going on when they do this? And in the book, I did my best to find an explanation that satisfied neuroscientists and that satisfied biohackers. But you're probably not going to be surprised to learn there are not a lot of universities studying this. There's not a lot of scholarly work going on about what happens when you put a magnet in your hand.
Yeah.
But yeah, so part of this book is about biohackers, and that is a really big group of people. I think, especially up here in the Bay Area, there are a lot of people who consider themselves biohackers because they are doing things to optimize their body, to optimize their work performance, using diet, using vitamin supplements, using wearable gadgets like smart wristbands, smart watches, to get metrics about things like heart rate or how far they've walked today, how well they've slept, all of those sort of things. The people that I focused on in my book are kind of like the mechanical engineering arm of the biohacker world. And these are people who are actually making devices for implants. They make the devices. Usually they go to a professional body piercer or body modification artist to actually have them implanted. So the magnetic implant that you described is what one of my favorite interviewees called the blood sacrifice to the grinder gods. It's like the gateway drug, the first thing that most people try. This guy is Tim Cannon of a group called Grindhouse Wetware, which is out in Pennsylvania. And this group has tried to build other devices that work in concert with an implanted magnet. So, for example, most people get these magnets implanted somewhere in their hand, usually in their fingertip. So Grindhouse made a device called Bottlenose that was essentially sonar. You would wear it over your finger, and then it would interact with the magnet in your hand to give you an idea of how close or how far away objects were. When I was there, I went to do my first in-person interview with them in November of 2013. They were starting to build this device that they were going to call the North Star. And the idea was that it would work with it would essentially be an in-hand compass. It would work with a magnet, it would sense direction, and it would light up when you face north. But before they could get there, they had to build a kind of a proof of concept device. And this was called Circadia. And when I was there, they had just put it in Tim's arm. And Circadia is about the size of a deck of cards, maybe a little bit smaller than your iPhone. No, it's definitely smaller than your iPhone, given how big iPhones have become. And it was in the kind of the plane of his lower left arm. And it was a temperature taking device.
On the top of his arm or underneath his?
Underneath it, on the interior plane.
Okay. And this means that somebody had to cut open his flesh, insert this thing, and seal it back up. And also, they have to, when you put foreign objects in the body doesn't seem to like that very much.
It was silicon coated. It wasn't just like putting metal in the body or anything like that. And it was done by a professional body piercer, body modification artist who works with silicon implants.
Okay.
So that said, they were basically testing this because they had a lot of questions about whether it would work, whether it would be harmful, whether it would hurt Tim. They needed to know things like, how can you keep recharging something that's under the skin? Mm-hmm. Is there going to be an immune system reaction? Is it going to hurt? It was pretty big. Mm-hmm. The idea was, so could a person wear it comfortably? So in the end, Tim wore it for 3 months, and it did successfully port information about his temperature from the implant out to his cell phone. So it was Bluetooth connected, and he was able to read out the information that way. They were able to charge it using a charging coil. It lit up. It lit up red and green, and it would light up when they held the charging coil to it. Ultimately, they realized that the battery section was expanding from the heat of the charging coil, so they took it out after 3 months. So he's not still wearing that one today. So
a lithium-ion battery inside your body is probably not the best thing to do. In the sense that it is a very reactive element, even if it's encased in silicon.
It is a difficult thing to do, and even for medical researchers who are working on implants for medical needs, like deep brain stimulation, which is used as a treatment for the tremor of Parkinson's disease. Mm-hmm. It's been used in clinical trials for epilepsy and severe depression. The question of how to power a device that's in the body over the long term is a big question.
Okay, so what did Grindhouse Wetware Group do after that piece?
So just a few weeks ago, just around Thanksgiving, they came out with their first version of the North Star. So this thing that I had seen basically as circuits on a breadboard when they were testing it that winter in Pennsylvania is now out as kind of a lightweight demo version. This version of the North Star, it lights up. It's red. It's kind of five-pointed It's actually a kind of a circular device the size of a quarter, and it has five lights in a star shape.
It's smaller. It's smaller than, yeah, that's good.
Yeah, but it doesn't have the compass in it yet. So it really doesn't give them any sensory perception. This is kind of their midpoint device. They're going to keep working on the compass part.
Where are they putting it?
Most people have it in the back of their hand.
And so it just lights up at this point, and they have to charge it again by induction coil of some sort?
Yeah, I think they're doing it by induction coil.
You want one of these things?
You know what? Actually, I was offered many implants, and I did not put myself on the list. I can't even wear a regular watch. You know, like I just get too creepy crawly with things on my body. So I'm not a good candidate for implants, I don't think.
This range of understanding how our senses work and how we pick up things and where the boundaries are has really changed over the year because we now have the ability to scan the brain real time with a live human and actually kind of investigate what they potentially are experiencing. There's been some really interesting research. Naomi Eisenberg researches physical and emotional pain.
The pain chapter of the book was really interesting to do. And one of the big things that Naomi Eisenberger's lab, she's at UCLA, and several other labs are doing, is trying to figure out if the brain treats physical pain, so that's like the pain of a broken bone, the same as emotional or social pain, which is the pain of rejection. Essentially, it's the pain of getting dumped. And what they've learned from fMRI studies is it's the same areas of the brain becoming active. They think in a very similar way. So the way that they test this is they kind of cross-check to see if a thing that cures physical pain will help social pain and vice versa. So one of the first experiments that Eisenberger's lab did in conjunction with a couple of other labs is they put people in the fMRI scanner and then they rejected them. And the way you reject somebody who's lying still in a tube is you have them play a game and then you very slowly leave them out of the game. So the people in the scanner are playing this game called Cyberball, which is kind of like a game of Frisbee. Okay. And then the other players start to leave them out. They stop passing them the ball. And it makes people feel socially rejected. Well, people who had taken Tylenol, or rather the generic version, which is acetaminophen, felt less rejection than the people who hadn't, which was really interesting. Wow. There was another study done up here at Stanford University where they said, okay, what about the other way around? What if we give people physical pain, but we remind them of love? Let's see what happens. So they put people in the scanner and they administered pain to them. This is usually done in the lab with something called a thermode, which is like a little, it gives them a mild burn.
Right.
And while people were getting this burn, they were looking at the picture of the person they were in love with. And it turns out that people who were looking at pictures of their beloved felt less pain than people who were looking at pictures of an equally attractive acquaintance. There was something about love that was a painkiller.
Wow. Amazing, because of course it makes sense that if you are emotionally in pain and you get sympathy from loved ones, it does help the pain.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that both directions, you can take potentially Tylenol to help you with emotional pain, and you can get hugs to help you with physical pain.
Yeah, this is the idea. One of the things that I did in this book was because it's actually really hard to watch people do anything in an fMRI scanner, and because I wanted to talk to people who had been emotionally rejected without having to follow people around and go to therapy sessions, which I thought would be a real bummer. Instead, I went to bars because I thought, who knows more about lost love than the bartender, right? And it turns out that, you know, what does a bartender do? They dispense a legal painkiller. They dispense alcohol. So I went to bars and I got a lot of people to talk about lost love and how it feels and how that pain seems to linger longer than physical pain, which is also something that has been shown by Eisenberger's lab and others in fMRI studies, which is basically you can recreate the pain of a breakup in your mind. You can recall that pain and feel it again in a way you can't with physical pain.
So with people at bars, you ask them to tell about their emotional stories of pain.
Yeah.
And that they could bring them back up. You can feel that pain for over a long period of time.
That's right. That's exactly it. And so one of the things that the researchers who are doing this told me is, okay, well, with the pain of passionate love, brand new love, which they defined as the people who are in the first 9 months of a relationship, so very early in the relationship, they think the mechanism for the pain killing is that it basically activates the brain's reward center, which is the same place that would be activated by caffeine or by cocaine or by chocolate. It basically, that reward center is a painkiller. Mm-hmm. With longer term relationships, they thought it was a different mechanism. They actually think what's going on there is that the sight or the presence of your loved one reduces your fear reaction. And that is, it's actually happening in a different part of the brain. It's a different mechanism for reducing pain. But that was kind of neat too, that there are probably multiple paths by which love can turn down pain and the other way around. And the people who were working on the Tylenol study said, well, you know, we haven't had a big mass experiment in giving Tylenol to the lovelorn, but lots of people had kind of anecdotally written into them and said, you know, I tried this at home. You might as well, why not? Right. So if anybody out there has done it, I'm curious to know if it works.
I'd caution against overdosing on Tylenol. It is one of the medicines that we can take that you can actually easily overdose on. So be careful with that.
Yeah, don't do that.
But fascinating that emotional pain can be so connected to physical pain. And it does make sense in some sense. There's many ways to interact with the brain. We don't understand it all. And so it does make sense that two different types of stimuli could still produce the same internal effect in the brain. And that if we're actually subduing that effect by a drug, that the drug would work for both types or multiple types, whatever that may be.
Right. And so there's an evolutionary argument behind this, which is that that pain is valuable, right? As animals, we need pain because it warns us when we're doing something that's dangerous to the body. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that the social pain mechanism just piggybacked on that because social rejection is dangerous for people. We're a pack animal. For most of our lives, we're dependent, you know, as children, we're dependent on adults to take care of us. And then when we're older, we need warning signals when we're doing something that is endangering us to separation from the group, right? When we're doing something that's so harmful or so repulsive to other people, that we're in danger of being left out. So they say, okay, this one mechanism harnessed the physical pain mechanism, the physical pain pathway, but they're both essentially doing the same thing, which is they're protecting us.
A lot of times when we're talking about interacting with the brain and figuring out new ways of adding to the senses, a great way to start without getting into that esoteric space of, you know, what is a sense? How do you actually, how would you perceive another sense? And how would your brain actually understand that? You go ahead and go with someone who's lost a sense and then try to reproduce it with machine, for example.
Yeah.
So Dean Lloyd lost his sight and has an artificial eye.
Dean Lloyd is one of the first people on the planet who has ever relearned how to see, which is an amazing thing. So Dean was born with normal vision, but he lost it as an adult to a genetic disorder called retinitis pigmentosa. And so he was essentially blind for 17 years of his life. He could see maybe a very bright light shining in his eye, but other than that, that was pretty much it. And he volunteered to be part of a clinical trial for a new retinal implant called the Argus 2. It's made by this company from Southern California called Second Sight. And this is in the United States, it's the first commercially available retinal implant ever. And the way it works is, so Dean wears a pair of glasses with a camera that's inset right over the bridge of his nose. And this device turns the images from the camera into electrical impulses, which then travel to an implant that's at the back of his eyes, actually physically inside his eye over the retina, which is the area at the very back on the inside. And then this device transmits electrical impulse to his surviving photoreceptors. There are still a few back there that work. And then these impulses are carried the rest of the way up the optic nerve to the brain and are processed as sight.
In a traditional way, or the way his body learned to do that when he was a child.
Right.
So you're saying that this is there a grid of sensors across the back of his retina so that it's kind of like a dot matrix of little electrodes?
Yeah, basically okay. there is an array at the end of this implant, and it has 60 points, I believe, uh-huh. Although in Dean's case, not all of them are working. So it's actually very, very low resolution vision, and it's not what he remembers from his life as a younger man before retinitis pigmentosa.
Sure.
So this world is basically not a world of images, three-dimensional shapes, objects, shading. It's a world of flashes. He sees flashes at contrast points where dark and light meet. Mm-hmm. So for example, one day we went for a walk, and as we were walking along, he could tell the difference between the white of the sidewalk we were walking on and the darkness of the asphalt to his left. And he could see these as kind of a flashes, you know, where dark and light met. When he would look at an oncoming car or a building, he would see them as the reflection off the glass in their windows. When he would look at me, he couldn't see any organic material. He could only see the glint off my eyeglasses. So that's what the world looks like to him. It's very sparse information. But that said, he can use it to get around. He can use the distance between flashes and the timing between flashes to figure out where he is. He can walk around with it. He can identify the objects that are in front of him. He could tell when a person is standing close to him or when they move away. It's very, very minimal information, but the brain is plastic enough that it can make sense out of this noise.
Yeah, and it's kind of a phenomenal that it is so plastic. I've heard of being able to take prisms on and put them on glasses and wear them, and after a day, you can see normally. Your brain actually rewires what you see to make it work again for yourself. So Dean's doing that same thing, just at a very severe level.
Yeah, and it makes you, it really made me think about, okay, what is vision, right? We're all used to what we see and this idea, but here's a person with a totally alternative construct for vision. One of the things that was really interesting that he told me is sometimes he sees random flashes of color, and it's probably because the implant is randomly stimulating one of his color receptors. Mm-hmm. So it has nothing to do with what he's looking at. It's just a burst of color. And what's amazing is this is an image that's happening in the brain, has nothing to do with the real world, has nothing to do with what's going on in the eyeball, right? It's just something that is happening electrochemically inside his head. And he loves it. He finds it beautiful. You know, he remembers what color was from before, and he is delighted to be able to experience it again, even if it has nothing to do with the object he's looking at.
I'm speaking with Kara Platani. We're talking about her book, We Have the Technology, all about how our senses work and how we're pushing the boundaries of our senses. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. We'll be right back. Kara Platani is a freelance science writer and lecturer at Berklee School of Journalism. Her recent book, We Have the Technology, explores how biohackers, foodies, physicians, and scientists are transforming human perception one sense at a time. And this goes all over from the senses we know very well, but also this idea of hacking our body to potentially give us new senses. I think it's fascinating that there's a whole group that's working on adding a compass to your body. I'm just curious, what's their intention of... I'm talking again about the Grindhouse Wetware group. Is it the idea they're going to piggyback off another sensory system like touch, and that's how they're going to get that information to the brain?
I think ultimately that is probably what's happening. That's probably the best neuroscientific explanation for what is happening, which is that they're taking novel information about, for example, magnetic things in their environment, and they're transmitting it through one of the existing five ports into the brain, which are touch, taste, smell, hearing, and vision. Mm-hmm. So they're using it in an existing sense, but they're putting new information through it. That said, you know, they are really very motivated by this idea that there are other animals out there that have sensory experiences that people don't, right? Like, for example, sharks can sense electricity, and lots of animals can sense magnetic fields. Usually these are migratory animals like birds and butterflies and sea turtles that have to know north and south. They have to know how to get home.
And ultraviolet, of course. A lot of insects see ultraviolet.
Right, of course. And a lot of insects do see ultraviolet. And so for the human eye can only see within a certain range, what we call the visible light spectrum. But there are other animals that can sense outside of that. So insects, for sure, like honeybees can see into the ultraviolet. And there are animals like the pit viper can sense infrared, although it's not quite clear to me if that's a visual experience or more like a heat touch experience to the pit viper. It's very hard to know what a pit viper is thinking. But you know, guys like the Grindhouse and some of the other biohacker groups that I talked to a group called Science for the Masses. I talked to a bunch of people who are kind of solo operators. They're kind of motivated by not only the sense of curiosity, but this sense of frustration with human limitations, right? Like, nature built this equipment. Why don't we have it? Or why can't we at least build an analog ourselves and try it ourselves? There's so much that so much information out in the world that is passing us by. They want to know what it is. So they say things to me like, why can't I sense gamma rays? I'm sorry. They'd say things to me like, why can't I sense gamma rays? You know, why can't I know when a supernova is going off in distant space? What would it be like to see a sunset in ultraviolet and infrared?
Well, let me be pessimistic here for a second. Why does it matter? I mean, in the sense that isn't the world that we perceive right now enough? Isn't it full enough? Why actually add these extra things?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And one of the answers that they would say is like, look, who should tell you how to stop improving your mind or your body? Who would say to you, no, you can't augment your mind through education? Or, no, you can't augment your body through exercise. Mm-hmm. No, you shouldn't be able to do things better than a previous generation did. It is a human thing to want to explore. It is a human thing to want to improve. And a lot of people would point out, look, we already do this all the time. We augment our bodies in so many different ways through ordinary technologies like eyeglasses or the pacemaker, the cochlear implant, right? Yeah, these things have been around for a long time. Or they would say, look at cosmetic surgery. You're allowed to have surgery for kicks for a cosmetic mm-hmm. reason, you know, for no medical purpose. If you want bigger boobs or a straighter nose, that's socially acceptable. Why not do something else?
Yeah, and especially if it's adding your ability to interact with the world even more. Because you could argue seeing the ultraviolet would allow you to see more of the world. It's not as just making yourself prettier for other people. It's something maybe engaging in the planet at a different level.
Right.
Totally fascinating. I think that augmentation level definitely gets to a point of like, ooh, it kind of creeps me out, the idea of cutting open my skin and putting something in it. At the same time, it's an amazing idea about being able to do more than what you currently can do. Because this idea of like, well, what does color actually mean to me? I enjoy it. If I added another color to my ability to sense, what is that? That's an amazing philosophical question. Absolutely.
Right.
But there is an eek factor to some degree about cutting into the tissue of your body. I think that we're probably in general culturally pushed and probably biologically pushed into not breaking our skin barrier, because of course that can lead to infection. And so over time, we've limited ourselves to doing that. Of course, a lot of people do. So fascinating. Can we talk about augmented reality?
Sure.
Actually, no. Let's talk about virtual reality first. And virtual reality, of course, is basically filling the senses completely such that you don't see the normal world, but you only see a fictitious world. So a screen in front of you, earplugs, maybe even a room that's padded and has a moving floor. So basically trying to put a barrier, computer barrier, between all your senses and the world so that you can insert new senses. Is that a good description of virtual reality?
Yeah, that's a good description of the criticism of virtual reality, right? Mm-hmm. Which is that you're too much inside the machine. You are wearing a big helmet or some kind of heavy goggles that are occluded, right? You can't see through them. Sometimes you have to go into a special lab. And virtual reality labs these days are really cool. They are very multi-sensory. So some of them have moving floors that vibrate. Some of them you can pump odors into them. They have surround sound. It's really a very immersive experience. Mm-hmm. But some of the critics of virtual reality split off to work in augmented reality. And they say it was too constraining. You were too much inside the computer. You were too much interacting with the virtual. What if you could interact with regular people, move around normally, wear the technology anywhere, and still be augmented? You get this extra layer of information, this extra layer of sensory perception, maybe some extended abilities thanks to something that you're wearing that is, if it's eyewear, it's partly see-through. So you can mm-hmm. still see the real world, and then you have the virtual world overlaid on it. Or it might be something like a smart watch, or a smart wristband. They're even working on smart clothing now, where, you know, things would actually be interwoven into the fibers of your jeans. So the idea is you still move more freely, you interact with people more naturally while you're getting this additional information fed to you.
The Apple Watch is one of those things that's kind of like an augmented reality thing that's mass market. I don't think it's been very successful in general, but it does do one thing that you touch upon in your book, and that is sharing a feeling, a sense remotely. And that is the heartbeat of a loved one. You can actually kind of enable and send your heartbeat to your loved one through the watch, right?
Yes.
And there's been research in that space a bit. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, well, so one of the things that was just, this was so amazing to me when Apple Watch came out with this feature, because one of the things that really inspired the guys at Grindhouse and other biohackers like them was Warren Ellis's Dr. Sleepless graphic novel series, which is where the term grinder comes from. In this novel, which is kind of a dystopian future in which people have kind of taken it upon themselves to make their own implants, to make their own augments because they're frustrated with the pace of technology. One of the things that people have is these implants in their palms so you can feel your loved one's heart beating in your hand, like couples get it, so they can feel each other's heart beating in their hand. And when Apple Watch came out with this feature, I thought, oh my God, it's real. You know, like the Dr. Sleepless universe and ours just got a lot closer, which is amazing. So it is sharing touch at a distance. And a lot of these augmented reality technologies are about transmitting some kind of sensory experience at a distance. Now, so far, most of them have to do with vision, some of them with sound. And that's because those things are much easier to render digitally than smell, taste, and touch. For smell, taste, you have to transmit a chemical, right?
Right.
Which is harder to do through a computer interface, although it can be done. And with touch, you actually need mechanical pressure. So again, you can send these directions through a computer, but you need a special device on the other end to release the scent or to stimulate somebody else's skin.
Yeah.
So it exists. But I went to labs that are doing some pretty cool experiments with this. One of them is in London. It's Adrian David Chiok's lab at City College London. And he's doing this thing with being able to transmit smell through the phone. So he has these little capsules that click onto your phone, and you can send somebody a text message along with a scent. One of the versions of this that they did was they did a collaboration with, I'm trying to remember, I think it was Oscar Mayer, some company that makes bacon, and they had turned people's cell phones into alarm clocks that would release the scent of frying bacon to wake them up. So that was kind of a cool thing in the transmission, long distance transmission of scent.
You know, with your story, with this discussion about pain, emotional pain and physical pain being alleviated in opposite, what we think of as opposite ways, and that Tylenol could alleviate emotional pain, it seems like if a hug from a loved one or the scent of touch from a loved one can actually help physical pain or emotional pain, which it seems that it does, then a virtual hug or a virtual heartbeat or whatever from your loved one seems like it could potentially also do that. I mean, that idea that our social creatures and we actually emotionally are affected by the interactions, we could make the interactions remote. It does seem like it would help or alleviate concern or pain. And it's kind of a cool connected world idea. I definitely, it's compelling to me.
Yeah. And so in fact, Adrian David Chiok, the scientist, one of the ways he got started on this was because he wanted to work on a project about could you remotely hug a pet? Because touch is so emotional, and he thought it would be like a very comforting thing. So he developed essentially a special jacket that a chicken could wear, and he created a way for you to pat the chicken remotely. And it worked. The chicken, the way they set the experiment up, the chicken had the option to go into the room where he would be hugged versus a room where he would be left alone. The chicken kept going in the room to be hugged, so the chicken seemed to like it. So then they built this project called Huggy Pajama, and the idea was that parents who are separated from their kids could give their kids a goodnight hug through these pajamas that had a tactile interface.
Did you try these on?
I didn't try it on. No, they weren't available. I'm also not sure that they're available in adult people sizes. Mm. But you know, when I was talking to him, he was saying, look, the world is so global now. Lots of people are separated from their loved ones.
Sure.
The device he was working on at the time that I was there is this little project called Ring You. And it's a ring, and you and your partner or your friend both wear the ring, and you can squeeze it, and you can send a little tiny, kind of like a little tiny hug, a little tiny pressure to the other person through their ring. It's kind of like the mood ring, but even moodier. And the idea is just to transmit the idea to somebody who's far away, I'm thinking of you, yeah. and to make it very discreet. Because one of the big problems with augmented reality gear so far has been that they just look dorky. They're cumbersome. You look like a, you know, you look like a robot.
I got Google Glass early on and wore it for a year and a half. So yeah, I definitely have that. I know that a feeling.
Right. Yeah. So did you find that people were reacting strangely to you?
It oddly opened me up to people because most people in the world wanted to know about it and ask about it, and I'd share it with them. So it actually added to my social interactions with strangers, which is kind of a neat side effect. But that's also because I'm that type of person that likes to chat with a stranger about technology.
Yeah, so that's interesting. The whole idea over what should the interface be for augmented reality devices is a really big field of discussion. Yeah. So in this lab, they were saying smaller, unobtrusive, let's make it look like anything else. And rings are very socially acceptable to wear. It's a very normal thing to wear.
So in researching this book for 3 years and really dedicating it so much to it, Kara, what's the most exciting to you at this point forward? Or what field, if you were to stop being a journalist, stop being a teacher and actually dive into something, which area would you get into?
Oh man. Okay. First of all, I don't think I can ever stop being a journalist. I think it's just in you. You can't get rid of it. But man, so many of these chapters, still feel to me like they're unfolding. Like I'm trying to stay in touch with these different labs to see what's going to happen next, what they're going to bring out next. One of the ones that I think, is not kind of the most hardcore technically, but I think will influence a lot of people in their lifetimes is, the work that I wrote about that has to do with Alzheimer's and sense of smell.
Yeah.
So this is the idea that, and I didn't know this before I started, but the first clinically observable symptom of Alzheimer's disease is problems with smell. And it doesn't mean that a person's sense of smell erodes entirely. In fact, some loss of smell is part of normal aging, but it means that people have trouble differentiating between smells. And a group of women in Paris who are all people who work for or have retired from the cosmetics industry came up with this idea to help people in hospitals, particularly people with Alzheimer's and other dementias. So they've created a library of scents. And the idea is that these are smells that would be very familiar to a person who grew up in France with French cooking and certain kinds of plants outdoors and certain kinds of products. And they, I went to observe them work with a group of very elderly patients in a geriatric ward, several of whom had Alzheimer's or other dementias. And what they would do is they would waft these smells under a person's nose and ask them what it was and try to help them recall memories and talk about it, which is, for people who have very advanced Alzheimer's or dementia, communication can be hard. They've lost a lot of the time the ability to identify things. They don't remember names. It's hard for them to talk to other people. Smell is so evocative. It's so emotionally resonant, so powerful that it can help people kind of come out of their shell. And the neat thing is this works even if people identify the wrong scent. Yeah. I had a group in Singapore doing a very similar project told me about giving the scent of jasmine to a man who had been born in India, born and raised in India. And jasmine is this kind of beloved flower smell that people from India would know very well. And he misidentified it as the smell of roses. But even though he misidentified it, he had this beautiful memory of how when he was a teenager, all the boys at his all-boys school would buy roses to give to the girls at the convent school across the street. And so even the wrong smell brought up this memory of long ago girlfriends for him and helped him have this kind of moment of pleasure, recalling the memory and talking about it to other people. And that was really cool. And given how prevalent diseases of aging are and are becoming as people live longer, this is kind of a creative way to think about a treatment. It's not a cure. It's just kind of a moment of relief. I thought it was a really neat form of biohacking.
Kara Platani, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The book is We Have the Technology, How Biohackers, Foodies, Physicians, and Scientists Are Transforming Human Perception One Sense at a Time. It's from Basic Books, and it was just released this December. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me. It's been so fun.
Kara's book is available all over the place. Of course, Amazon and Powell's and Barnes & Noble's and all that, but also your local bookstores, especially in Oakland, San Francisco, and even here in Santa Cruz at Bookshop Santa Cruz. She's got a very friendly cover with a guy with glasses kind of shouting out with electricity. Kara is also going to be touring in January and March throughout California. Look, I just want to make a personal note about this book. If you love this kind of topic, this book covers it fantastically. Lots of discussion and description, and it's not dry science. It's rich with color. And I mean, you can't write a book, I'm assuming, about the senses without using them in your writing. And it reads lovely. I highly recommend We Have the Technology. And since I'm talking about recommendations, and it's the end of the year, it seems like a good opportunity for me to give you a recommendation from my geek cred experience to you. And that is, well, it's a simple thing to do. And it'll relieve stress for the entire year. It'll take you about a day to really do it right. And it'll take you some money. And here's what I'm talking about. You probably have a smartphone and you've taken photos with it. You might have a digital camera that you've uploaded your photos to your computer at one point. And the question I have is, if those things all went away, your smartphone got dropped in the river, or your computer completely, hard drive died, would you miss those photos? Normally that is a yes. And there's other things as well in those computers. Well, right now, at the end of the year, take this time where you probably have some time off work, you're around the house, go ahead and go pick up one of these big, plump, beautiful hard drives, these terabyte hard drives. They're USB, which will fit any computer, and they're not that expensive, but they're large. Probably larger than the hard drive on your computer, which means you can make a full copy backup. And these little external hard drives, they're sometimes small and large, doesn't really matter, but you pick up one that makes a good price and will fit on your desk. Plug it in your computer. On a Mac, you're just going to use Time Machine, and it's going to back up your machine regularly for you really easily. And if anything goes bad with your hard drive on your computer, you get to recover it. And everybody else, there's software on this drive that you pick up, this new hard drive, will have a backup solution. So it alleviates everything. You plug it in your computer, you set it up. It'll take a little time to set it up, but once you do, no more stress about losing all that data. Your hard drive, your computer, all the files you care about, those family photos are all saved and protected. And you won't have to stress about losing them. It's a good gift for yourself for the new year. So go ahead and pick up a hard drive and set up your backup solution. It's not that difficult, and the stress relief will be wonderful. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Feel free to use our stuff whatever you'd like. Just tell them the geeks say hi. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit GeekSpeak.org. And while you're spending some time online, why don't you go up to iTunes and rate us? You know, let people know you listen to the show. We do have a podcast via iTunes, so please subscribe from there or any of your podcasting catching software you prefer. Just search for KUSP Geeks. We're also KUSP Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. And, of course, you can email us with questions and comments for anything we talk about. We'll cover it on air if it's appropriate. geeks@geekspeak.org. For KUSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week and see you online.